How are we doing, everybody? Hi, welcome to Skype a Scientist Live. Today we are talking about archaeology for the fourth day in a row because we are in Archaeology Week. Today we are super lucky to have Dr. Eric Klein here with us today, who's going to be digging in deep with archaeology and explaining to us basically how archaeology works. If you have any questions, please submit them to the Q&A. Eric is going to go through about a 15-minute presentation, and then we'll open it up to the Q&A. At this point, Eric, I'm going to hand it over to you and hide for a little bit. We're super, super happy that you were able to join us tonight.
Great. Thank you. And it's wonderful to be here. Thank you all for being here. I'm going to try and share my screen and see if we can get this working here. And get it going. There we are. And yeah, what I figured I would do is just give you a little bit of an introduction and then answer your questions for the rest of the time. So to put it simply, I think the job that I've got, my profession, is one of the coolest around. I get to save the past, I save it for us, that is the present, and I save it for the future. And so I hope that some of you in the audience tonight will do the same. So one of the things that I was talking about, let's see, hold on, there we go. One of the things that I'm frequently asked is, when did I decide I wanted to become an archaeologist? And the answer was when I was about 7 years old. It was my mother's fault. She gave me this book that you see on the left there. It was a biography written for children of Heinrich Schliemann, the man who found the fabled city of Troy and proved, at least to his satisfaction, that the Trojan War was not just a myth and a legend, but was in fact based in reality. And I kind of agree with him. So I read that when I was seven. I announced I wanted to be an archaeologist. And when I graduated from college with my degree in archaeology, my mother gave me the book again, and I still have it today. It's in my office at George Washington University. So I've pretty much always wanted to be an archaeologist. And when I was in high school, that was pretty much cemented because I read two books. One was quite popular a while ago by C.W. Saram, called Gods, Graves, and Scholars. And the other was by a guy named John Stevens, who traveled down in Central and South America and wrote a couple of books about that. And that pretty much cemented my desire. So basically reading these books when I was young made my career decision pretty easy. And so I've actually now done the same, kind of come full circle. I wrote a book, came out about 3 years ago in 2017, called Three Stones Make a Wall, which comes from a saying in archaeology, one stone is a stone, two stones is a feature, three stones makes a wall. And what I wanted to do was to update Saram's book, Gods, Graves, and Scholars, because that was published about 50 years ago with no update. So mine was meant to be the update. And then based on that, we've just spun off a much smaller one with just kind of the digging deeper chapters, which is answering how archaeology itself works. Because the bigger book has all the sites, Pompeii and Rome and Athens and you name it, Chichen Itza. But there were segments inside it as to, you know, how do you know where to dig? How do you know how old something is? And so we decided to spin this off, and it's actually coming out in November for only like 10 bucks. And I meant it for people such as yourselves who want some of the brief answers to their questions. But I also wanted it for people that are about to go on their first excavation that want to know what to expect. So it's a little book, fits in your back pocket, but hopefully it will be of interest and use. So if some of what we talk about tonight piques your interest, or if we didn't get to your question, then it may be in that little book. But I can tell you, here's some of the questions that I answer in there. I've already looked at when did I want to become an archaeologist. I'm often asked, what's the best thing that I've ever found? And that is actually fairly easy to answer. And so I wanted to spend a moment going over that. Before I open it up to questions, these are the places where I've excavated over the last 30 years. I started out in Israel at Tel Anafah when I was a sophomore in college, dug around in Greece and then Cyprus, Egypt, Jordan, back to Cyprus, over to Crete, back to Greece, and the last 20 years or so, I have been excavating back in Israel again at Megiddo and Kabri. So the best find I ever made actually are bookends at Tel Anafah when I began and at Tel Kabri now where we are today. So when people used to say to me, what's the best thing you've ever found? I would say a petrified monkey's paw. And it was found at Tel Anafah. You see it on the map here. It's in what is modern day Israel, just north of the Sea of Galilee or Lake Tiberias. You can see the little mound of Anafah there. This was an excavation that was run by University of Michigan. And I went, as I said, when I was a sophomore in college. And so there I am, way back when I had brown hair and was skinny. That was a long time ago. And in this, at this site, there was something that we didn't do then that we do now. And that is when we dig now, the entire site is covered over in black shade cloth. So we're digging in shade. Because back here, about 1980, we didn't know much about skin cancer and all of that, at least the archaeologists didn't. So we would just dig out in the sun with no shorts on. And it just so happened that one day at about 9 a.m, I was already kind of getting sunstroke. And I was digging away with my little patiche, my little hammer. And all of a sudden it hit something at such an angle that instead of just staying in the ground, it flew up in the air. And as it was up in the air, kind of turning somersaults, I thought to myself, oh, it's green. It's a petrified monkey's paw. But by the time it landed, I thought, no, wait a minute. There weren't any monkeys here in Israel in antiquity. So what is it? Well, it turned out when I picked it up that it was a little tiny bronze figurine. This is the same thing in both pictures. This is the left one is right after I found it. And the right one is a little bit later that day. And it turned out to be a bronze implement that's at the end of the arm of your chair. Imagine if you're sitting in a wooden chair and your hand, your arms are on the arms of the chair. This would be at the very end of it, so you would grab onto it. And it's actually the Greek god Pan, the guy that has horns and plays a double flute and wanders through the forest. Because this was a Greek site at that time. So that was kind of cool. That was the best thing I ever found. But they told me that they were taking it down to Jerusalem to put it in the National Museum. I went down there. I never saw it. And then 30 years later, in 2010, when we were digging at Tel Kabri up in the north of Israel, we went down to University of Haifa to bring some stuff into storage. And I wandered into their museum. And from across the room in the Greco-Roman display, I saw this circled in red. And I went closer. I said, that looks a lot like what I found. And then when I got right up to it, I said, wait a minute, that is what I found. And sure enough, it was on loan from the museum in Jerusalem. So I quickly took a picture of it. And just to be safe, I took a picture of myself. I did a selfie with it. And that was good because when I came back the next week to show my students, it was gone. It had already been returned back to Jerusalem. So I'm glad I took these pictures. So for the longest time, I was telling people that was the best thing I found. But then in 2013, at our site of Kabri, which you see over by the Mediterranean coast, just north of Haifa, in 2013, we found this room chock-a-block full of storage jars. Each one was about 3 feet tall. And it turned out when we did organic residue analysis, we were able to tell what was in it. And it turned out to be wine. The wine is now all gone. The jars are full of dirt. So I tell people the wine has kind of an earthy taste. But we were able to tell that there was wine in there and the additives. So they were flavoring it with juniper berries and mint and resin to keep it from going bad. And so that is now supplanted my petrified monkey's paw with having found a palatial wine cellar. because that site is from the Canaanite period, from about, well, almost 4,000 years ago, 1900 BC or BCE, around about the time that Abraham was walking through the area. And so we now have not just that room, but in the next couple of seasons, we found three or four more rooms and about another 100 jars. So we have basically either a small wine cellar or a small winery. And that, I would now tell people, is the best thing that I found. But if you had asked me when I was 7 years old what I thought I would find in my career, I would never have told you a wine cellar or a petrified monkey spa. And that is how archaeology is. You never know what you're going to find. And for me, that is part of its magic and its appeal. And the newspapers and media got a hold of this afterward. We made Time Magazine, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, and that was a lot of fun, especially when I was able to show it to my family. So it's a rewarding career, lots of fun, and you never know what you're going to find. So some of the other questions that I'm asked and that I answer in the little book, how do you know where to look? Is it easy to learn how to dig? How do you know how old something is? You get to keep what you find. I thought I would save some of that for the question and answer period now, though I can answer the last one right away in one word. Do I get to keep what I find? The answer is no, I do not. It stays in the country where we find it. So with that, I'm going to stop sharing my screen and open it up to your questions and answers and see where we go from there.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that with us. That was already so, so cool. So, so you've mentioned this petrified monkey's claw, and I think we need to go back because you're like, yeah, well, I found this petrified monkey's claw. Why were there petrified monkey claws? What were they doing with them? I just need more details on that line.
Inquiring minds need to know. Yeah. Well, to begin with, I'm sorry, there weren't any petrified monkey's paw. It was just my addled brain out in the sun going, this little thing is green and it looks kind of fuzzy. And I thought it was like a rabbit's foot kind of thing. And I'm like, oh, petrified. And then I'm like, no. Can't be right. And it is true. There were no monkeys in that area back then. But in the minute I picked it up, I'm like, oh, wow, this is more cool, right?
Yeah.
And it was like more than 2,000 years old. It was way cool.
Awesome. So we've got a question from Cynthia. Can you talk about what happens when you find an artifact? Where does it go after you remove it from its context and before it finds its way into a museum?
Excellent question. So when we first find something, it goes back to wherever we're living at the time. So, when you're on an excavation, you end up staying anywhere and everywhere. So I've stayed in elementary schools that were empty for the summer. I've stayed in abandoned hotels. I've camped out, you name it. Fortunately, when we're digging in Israel, for example, most of the kibbutzim have guest houses. And so we rent it out. It's interesting on the weekends because, of course, people coming on holiday are there as well. But what we do is we bring the objects back, and if it's pottery, we spend the afternoon washing it because we want to get the dirt off so we're able to tell what date it is. And if you've got a pottery specialist, they can pick up the piece of pottery, and by looking at the edges as well as the shape, they can go, oh yeah, this is Greek, or this is Roman, or this is early Bronze Age. And then we take it, in our case, like since I'm partners with Asafios Orlando at University of Haifa, that's the place where we store everything, and that's where they have the conservation laboratories and the laboratories where they study them. So when we're done for the season, we pack everything up in bags and boxes, take it down to the university. That's why I was in the museum that day, and I saw them at the Petrified Monkey's Paw. We were bringing stuff down from the season. And then it's unpacked and laid out on tables, and during the year, the professors and the students will study the various objects and the pottery. And the best stuff will then go down to the museum. And the other stuff basically gets bagged back up and put into storage boxes and down in the subterranean cellar of the university. because at some point somebody is going to want to pull it out and study it. Because everything that we've done, somebody will do it for a PhD dissertation in 20 years or whatever. So there's all these stages that it goes through, but nothing's ever thrown out. We keep everything.
So I feel like over the last 500 years, we've uncovered a lot of stuff. So how do museums find space for all this stuff?
This is part of a problem. We always have to build new museums.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the first excavations were really in Pompeii, like in the 1700s. So we're coming up on a couple hundred years of finding stuff. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the earliest excavations, like at Pompeii and Herculaneum, were basically collectors looking for statues for their gardens. Right. So from there, we get the first museums. And then you just start building more and more and more. And in fact, some of the early explorers and archaeologists were in fact sent out by the museums to bring stuff back, right? So British Museum, the Louvre, museums in Germany, even the Met and the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. So yeah, but that part of the problem is storage, because we find so much. So any museum you go into will have just a certain amount of their collection on display, and the rest is in the storerooms, and it's frequently open to scholars to study, but they also rotate their exhibits, and they put up new and traveling exhibits. So, but yeah, storage can be a problem because you find an awful lot of stuff on every dig.
Totally. So I know right now during the pandemic, a lot of museums are having a really tough time financially. And so I read somewhere that about a third of museums are at risk of never opening again after the pandemic. So right. If that were to happen, what's going to happen to all of the stuff in those museums?
Excellent question. And I honestly don't know the answer to that. I'm hoping that they're all able to bounce back. But yes, all the museum curators are in such a tough situation right now. So something has to happen, obviously. If it's there, you can't just, have a fire sale or something.
Right.
So, but I'm crossing my fingers for all my friends and my former students that are museum curators, that there's going to be something still there for them when all of the current pandemic is over.
Yeah, it's a stressful time.
Oh, yeah.
The next question's from Katie Oakley. What type of tools do you use for excavation?
So, excellent question. We use all kinds of tools, some of which you might expect and some of which you might be surprised at. A lot of people come up, to me at dinner parties laughing and say, "So, do you really dig with toothbrushes and dental tools?" And I look at them with a straight face and go, "Yeah, I do. But only in very delicate situations." For example, when we're excavating skeletons, that's when the toothbrushes and the dental tools come out. What surprises people is on a daily basis, I say, we use things like pickaxes and shovels. I mean, it's big, heavy tools, manual work, physical labor. And they're a little surprised. They're like, "Why would you use a pickaxe?" I'm like, "Well, because time is money, and if you're digging through a level where there's like nothing there, you've got to get through it down to where there is stuff." But also, my friend and colleague Israel Finkelstein, probably one of the most famous Israeli archaeologists working today, I dug with him at Megiddo for 20 years, and he used to say, "Used properly, a pick is the most delicate instrument on the tell." And then he would demonstrate it, and he wielded it like a scalpel. It was absolutely amazing. But by far, the major things that we use, and bear in mind, I'm talking about from the viewpoint of somebody who digs in the Mediterranean, right? Greece, Rome, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Turkey. We use a combination of the trowels, like a garden trowel, except not just any trowel. You can't just go down to your local hardware store. American archaeologists prefer a Marshalltown. That's the specific brand. But the British archaeologists swear by WHS trowels. WHS are a little bit smaller and less flexible. But I've had a WHS trowel. My mother gave it to me when I was 21, and I still have it. So it's an artifact. All right. And then the other is the little digging hammer. And I would say we use trowels and digging hammers about 80% of the time. And then another, not quite 10%, we use the picks. And then rarely, very rarely, we use the dental tools and the toothbrushes because we don't find skeletons that often.
Right. Yeah. One of our questions here was, do you ever find dinosaur bones? And it's like, well, you kind of know what you're getting yourself into in an area, like to some extent. Like, you know whether you're going into like a dinosaur depth area or a human depth area, right?
Exactly. Right. So on my digs, I would never find dinosaur bones because we're not digging where dinosaurs were. Right. So, but if you're digging somewhere else, I don't know, Wyoming or somewhere like that, and you're specifically on a dig for dinosaurs, then you would. But that's also a different specialty. Those are paleontologists. Right. And people frequently get them. And I'm like, I don't dig dinosaurs. I'm an archaeologist. I dig humans. So if you want to dig dinosaurs, you'll go be a paleontologist. You want to go dig humans and human remains, you'll be an archaeologist.
Very cool. So we have a question here from Lynn. You've been working on archaeology sort of through the start of using DNA for a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. DNA analysis has become so much less expensive over time and more widely used. Over your career, have you seen an increase in using DNA to analyze anything that you find?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The using DNA has exploded in the last, not even decade, half a decade. So it used to be that we didn't have the technology to do it. So, but in the last 5-10 years, sure. And in fact, we were trying it this past summer. We found a burial at Cabri and we were trying DNA on it. The problem with us was it was too deteriorated. And so, you know, we could tell there was something there, but we couldn't read it. But at Ashkelon a couple of years ago in the south of Israel, they found an entire cemetery and were able to do ADNA, ancient DNA, on, dozens of skeletons with really good results. So, but even there, the DNA was in such fine amounts that they had to boost it before they could really look at it. But yeah, this is the way of the future. We're going much more hard science. We're still always going to have to excavate and everything like that, but we're bringing in the exact sciences, the life sciences. So in addition to DNA, we're doing things like strontium isotope analysis, where you look at somebody's teeth and you can tell where they grew up because the enamel's got the stuff stuck in there. So we're using all kinds of scientists to help supplement the actual digging. Once we find it, that's just the first step now. Then we get to really analyze it. And that's why this is such a cool time to be an archaeologist right now. We're learning so much, but there's still so much to do.
That's so cool. I know there's like a whole lot of different ways that we can look at DNA in the environment. There's what's called eDNA, which is like, this is something that squid biologists use. I'm a squid biologist. And we'll maybe like take some water and basically look for signs that a certain animal that we're interested in has been there. Now, what is aDNA and how does that process differently than we might do just like basic squid DNA straight out of a squid?
Now that, I don't know, because I hire somebody to do that.
Right. Okay.
Right. In fact, my friend Philip Stockhammer, who's over in Germany, he's the person to ask for that. But basically, yeah, we ship our stuff to him and his team. And we say, you know, work your magic and then tell us what we've got. So, but it's so specialized that we each have our own little compartments there.
Awesome. Very cool. The next question is, what do you do when you find an artifact that's over 1,000 years old and you know that it's been missing for a long time? And like, as an addition to that, like, how do you tell other people maybe in your field that you found it?
So let's see. The first part was how do we...
What do you do once you find something that like maybe people have been looking for 1,000 years?
We celebrate. We're like, yay, we found it. Yeah. The thing is, mostly what we usually don't go searching for something. We go to answer a research question, like the rise of rulership, or when did they domesticate this type of animal, or something like that. In finding something, it's usually kind of unexpected. Like the wine cellar at Cabri, we thought we were digging outside the palace. We had a massive wall that we thought was the western wall of the palace. So we wanted to compare what was in the palace to what was outside. We thought we were outside, and then all of a sudden we hit these huge jars. And we're like, we're not outside the palace. And then somebody's like, wait, we're in the storage rooms. We're like, that's cool. And then we went, yay. And then to answer the second part of your question, we announced it. But the way we announced it, and I don't like it when people, as we call it, publish by press conference. So when you announce something, we wait to announce it until it's about to be published, and we coordinate the PR with the actual article so the people that are interested can go read the article in addition to the newspaper accounts. Mm-hmm. So in the case of our wine cellar, we had it all set. It was accepted. It was coming out in a journal called Plus One, which you can read on the internet because we made it open access. Right, just Google my name and Kabri, K-A-B-R-I, and wine, and it'll come up. And so that makes it so that the scientists can read it, our colleagues, and the general public can read it, but they can also read the newspaper accounts or Time Magazine or anything. So the big thing for us is, celebrate it and announce it, but announce it properly so that it is scientifically backed up. And those who are really interested can read about it immediately rather than us saying, oh, you have to wait 6 months or 6 years for us to publish it. So we tend to keep it very quiet. The Ashkelon Cemetery, they were quiet for 3 years before they announced their results. So it can be hard. So like in the case of the Ashkelon, I knew the people that were excavating it. I had no idea they were excavating it. And then, when they announced it, I went to them, I said, hey, why didn't you tell me anything about that? It's like, because we weren't telling anybody. I'm like, but I'm not just anybody. I'm like your former professor. They're like, no, you're just anybody. I'm like, okay, fine. I know. So you have to keep, it's kind of like keeping a secret for a while, but it's worthwhile because when you announce it, you've done it properly.
That's great. That's solid. Awesome. The next question is from Julian. We know that you have worked mostly in Europe and over, but Julian wants to know, has anybody found fossils in Virginia Beach?
Ooh, good question. I don't know the answer to that. I wouldn't be surprised if they have, though, because you find them absolutely everywhere. So go take a look. Or if you found something that you think might be a fossil, take it to the local museum or the local university and ask somebody if they can help you identify it. But yeah, there's stuff absolutely everywhere. And I have dug in the States, actually. I dug in Vermont when I was in college, and I've dug in California also. So, but that's it. Everywhere else has been overseas. And in part for me, that's the fun. For a while, when I was younger, I was picking a country I hadn't been to before and then finding an excavation and joining it. And I would travel for 3 weeks before and 3 weeks afterward. So that was a lot of fun.
That's great. That's awesome. That's a side bonus to science that you don't always hear about. getting between conference travel and field work. Yeah, it's awesome.
Right. Exactly.
The next question is from Jen. Hi, Eric. Can you say a little bit about how technologies like drones and satellite images are being used in archaeology today?
Absolutely. Hi, Jen. How are you? Yes. These are one of the new technologies that are really taking over. It used to be that we did aerial photography, putting a camera up and a kite and flying it up there. That's what the excavators from Chicago did at Megiddo back in the 1920s and 30s. Now we've got all this incredible technology, including drones. Mm-hmm. And it used to be that there were a couple of digs that had it, and they were, the early adopters. But now almost every excavation has their own drone, and some have several. We actually don't have a drone of our own because we hire a company that comes with 3 or 4 different drones. And they're like, we'll take the same thing using a couple of different shots. Those have really changed our lives in a way because we can now photograph and map stuff in just a matter of hours where it would usually take days or weeks. Mm-hmm. But we've also got, along those same lines, new technologies like LIDAR, which LIDAR, light emitting radar, stands for something like that. It basically, you can see through the trees, you can see through the jungle. So they use it a lot down for Maya sites, like in Belize and the Honduras, and you can actually see the city. There's a city called Caracol in Belize that it's completely covered by jungle, but using LIDAR, you can see it like plain as day. They've also used it from a helicopter in like regions like Cambodia and by Angkor Wat. So this is some of the new technology that we've got that is helping us to map it. And in fact, the LIDAR, even though you mostly use it from a little airplane and a helicopter, you can also use it at ground level. And we, in fact, used it at Cabri to map our wine cellar, that first room we found with the 40 jars. We hired a company with LIDAR. They set it up in the middle of the room, and it wasn't even 3 hours. And they said, all right, we're done. We mapped everything. And they had hundreds of thousands of data points, including telling us what the capacity of the jars were. We thought they had held maybe like 50 liters of wine. No, they held 113 liters each. They were more than double what we had estimated. They did it in under 3 hours. If we had mapped and drawn it ourselves, it literally would have taken about 3 weeks. So the downside is it's expensive. I think it was a couple thousand dollars for those 3 hours, but it was worth it. It was absolutely worth it. So yeah, drones and LIDAR and all this new technology is really changing the face of archaeology. And drones in particular are important for tracking looting, right? You can tell if a site's been looted when you're not there by flying drones over it at certain intervals. So they're really, really useful.
Right. Oh, that's super cool. So I am now thinking back to 1993's Jurassic Park, when they sent those like shockwaves through the earth to try to like get a visual of the velociraptor they were digging. Is there anything in real life that does that, like with your digs, to try to be like, is there anything here? Kind of like a metal detector of archaeology.
Yes and no, yes and no. There were some people way back when that used to do exactly that. They would set off like dynamite and send shockwaves through the earth and record it to see if there were any tombs or things like that. Nowadays, we're not quite setting off dynamite anymore. We are doing what we would call remote sensing. And that does allow you to peer through the earth at ground level. And it takes a number of different forms. It depends on the soil of the site that you're digging, what will work and what won't work. So you can use things like magnetometers, which will measure the magnetic force and direction in your area. If humans have been there messing with the dirt, it will alter the magnet force in the earth. So you can measure that. You can also do electric resistivity, put down two poles and run an electric current between them. And if there's something there like a wall or a ditch, it'll break the current and you can see like that. You've also got ground penetrating radar, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's radar that sends a being into the earth. So you can do things like that. But it depends on the site. So at Cabri, we haven't had good luck. We've tried it, and it ends up looking like squiggles, like a kindergartner would write with crayon on a piece of paper. Uh-huh. And I'm like, I don't see anything. But at another site, a colleague of mine, David Sloan, who dug at a site called Zincirli, which is southeastern Turkey, they did the magnetometer there, and it was, oh my, you can see the city without ever having dug. Wow. And same thing at Troy, where Heinrich Schliemann found the city of Troy at Hissarlik. The modern excavators that were there between, in this case, 98 and 2005, they tried 8 different types of magnetometers before they found the one that worked. It's called a cesium magnetometer. They could see the entire lower city of Troy that nobody knew was there before then. Now it turns out Troy is 10 to 15 times bigger than we ever thought it was.
Wow.
And you can see right into the earth without ever having dug. But cautionary tale, you need to do what we call ground truthing, where you go to look and see if what you see on the images is real, because sometimes it's backwards. So for instance, at Troy, they said, we found a wall. And when they excavated it, it turned out it wasn't a wall, it was a ditch. But the ditch had filled up with stones, so it looked solid and it looked like a wall, but it was actually a ditch. So you have to be careful of these things. But yeah, so we don't set off dynamite anymore. We've got better techniques than that. But I'm hopeful for even more. It may be wishful thinking, but I'm hoping that at some point we can use something like, you know, like they use at TSA and the airports, and I want to be able to scan a site and it just tell me not just you have a wall in there, but like there's a floor made of plaster that's 10 feet in and 5 feet down. Mm-hmm. If we can test for things like that, and somebody told me at one point that we should actually work together with oil and gas exploration experts, because they're doing in some ways the same sort of thing. So this is where fields can merge. And I have hopes that we're going to keep doing remote sensing, because if we can figure stuff out without digging, that'll save a lot of money.
For sure. Yeah. Awesome. Thanks. Yeah. The next question is, what do you think the most exciting find of 2019, 2020 has been by anybody?
By anybody of 2019, 2020, each person you ask is going to give a different answer, right?
Sure, yeah.
For me, it was the cemetery at Ashkelon, which was announced in July of 2019. And I was actually privileged enough where I was asked for my comment before it was announced. So they sent me an embargoed copy of the article before it appeared. And I'm like, oh, this is so cool. This is so cool. And I had to talk, two different groups sent it to me. One I had to email back, and the other actually called me on the phone, because we were digging at Cobbery. We were out in the field. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing was that then they embargoed our comments also. But when the media reports came out, like in National Geographic and Smithsonian and all that, I was one of the people where they said, Eric Klein, who was not affiliated with this project, comments. And I said, yeah. Right. So the funny thing was that I was at Cobbery, and I was kind of bursting with the news, but I couldn't tell anybody because I'd been sworn to secrecy. So all the articles comes out, the news comes out, and my co-director and I and the associate director, we all get together, and I'm like, so guys, I wasn't able to tell you this for like the last week, but, and they both looked at me and they said, same. And we had all been contacted,
right,
and nobody knew.
So, they should tell you who else they're telling. So you can like at least excitedly talk to each other about it.
Yes, exactly. Ooh, so for me, that was the most interesting, in part because it fed into my own research, because mm-hmm. I've been researching the Sea Peoples and the collapse of the Bronze Age, and I wanted to know where the Philistines had come from, and mm-hmm. they have part of the answer now.
Right. That's super cool. Let's see. So what of all of your digs has been the most dangerous?
The most dangerous? Oh, my. That's a very good question. I've never thought of it in that way. Gosh, well, they all have scorpions, so that's kind of dangerous. Yeah. You want to watch out the yellow ones and the black ones. You have to figure out which is which. But I think probably the most dangerous was actually 2006. I was digging in the north of Israel. I was actually at Megiddo. And the Hezbollah war broke out with Lebanon. And so we were all evacuated. And I had students with me. So I got like emails from the president. Are you guys still there? I'm like, yes. President of GW, not the US.
Yeah.
And he's like, could you please come back with the students? And so yeah. I think that was both dangerous and scary. But we all made it back. And then I think that was probably the most dangerous situation I found myself in. Mm-hmm. But others have much more scary stories to tell. I've had a relatively boring existence as an archaeologist, I think you could say. My main claim to fame was walking into a field with a bull that didn't want me there when I was surveying in Greece. And another time, I think there was a farmer with a shotgun who demanded to know what I was doing on his land. But then when I said I was an archaeologist and showed him what we were doing, he put the shotgun away and said, come here, I'll show you, look what I found. And he showed us the site, and he had found an ancient site on his land. So, you know, once you say an archaeologist, everybody gets happy, usually for the most part.
Sounds good. Melissa and Bill Morrison would like to know, you mentioned looting. Can you talk a little bit more about why that's a problem?
Yes, I absolutely can. And hello, Melissa and Bill. Been a while since I've seen you. Looting is probably the number one problem worldwide. Looting is everywhere from Peru to Jordan to Iraq. Usually it's on, well, it used to be, it was on a small scale, local farmers, like the one I just mentioned, people in villages trying to make a second income. They find something, they sell it to a middleman. But even that is definitely problematic. Looting at any rate is. But then it becomes kind of a almost a multinational organization where you've got, you know, like crime bosses coming in. And the looting of just entire sites is horrible, especially in the aftermath of war. So in Iraq, for instance, when they looted the Baghdad Museum and then proceeded to loot many of the sites in the country, that's all knowledge that is irrevocably lost. Some of the stuff shows up on the art market, and we kind of don't touch that with a 10-foot pole, but sometimes you have to. There was a cache of tablets that came out that seems to have been from a town called Judahtown from the Jewish exiles that were off in Babylon after Jerusalem was destroyed in 586 BC or BCE. And there, you know, kind of had to buy them because otherwise it's lost, but you don't know where they come from. Right. So looting is absolutely, it's the number one problem, as I've said. And that's where my answer to my last question, do I get to keep what I find? I said, no, I don't get to keep them. I personally don't think that there should be private collectors either. I don't think that any of us should be. I mean, Indiana Jones once said that belongs in a museum, and that's fine. You know, that's a whole nother story though. But in terms of private collectors, that's what drives the market, and that's what drives the looting. So if we could just stop everybody from doing personal collecting, the looting would go way, way, way down, hopefully to a manageable level. But that is the number one problem today, as I've said. And the loss to our knowledge is irrevocable. If I show you something I've dug up, that is really, really useful. If I show you the same exact thing, but it was bought on the art market, it's lost like 90% of its cultural value because I don't know what it was found with, and I don't know where it was found, and I don't know the date for its context and all of that. So, wow. So yeah, looting, if I knew how to fix it and stop it, that would be wonderful. But this is what a lot of people are working on today. People like the Antiquities Coalition are helping to get MOUs with other countries, mm-hmm. right? There was a memorandum of understanding with Greece, which is being renewed right now, and another with Bolivia. And there was one recently signed with Egypt, and another law that went through with Syria. So we're trying to stop this, but it is, as I keep saying, a major problem.
For sure. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. We try to keep these sessions to be about 45 minutes, and we're coming up on that now, but we've got three questions left, and so I'm going to try to do rapid fire last okay. questions. Are you ready?
Let's Short see. Answer, yes.
All right. From James, is there anywhere that you'd like to dig that you haven't been able to dig yet?
Yes, I would love to dig somewhere in Sicily, Sardinia, Western Italy, specifically to find the Sea Peoples. And I think that at least part of the Sea Peoples originated there. There's a group called the Sardana that's probably from Sardinia, the Shekelesh maybe from Sicily, and yet we don't know where the Sea Peoples come from. So somebody once asked me if I had $1 million, where would I go dig? And that would be my answer, was Western Mediterranean, looking for the origins of the Sea Peoples.
Awesome answer. Next question. What is your most inspiring quest?
My most inspiring quest?
Yes.
Quest. What happened in the Bronze Age between, say, 2000 and 1000 BC? Who was interacting with whom? I think that's the most interesting period in history. It's the time period of King Tut, for example, and Hatshepsut and Akhenaten, and they're all busy trading with each other and having embassies, and it was one of the most globalized time periods in history. And actually, just between all of us, I would love to go back in time and be there for 24, 48 hours and see what goes on.
Awesome. Sounds good. And your last question, how often do you have students and what inspired you to be an archaeologist?
So let's see. Inspired me to be an archaeologist was the books that I read when I was younger, right? The one for Heinrich Schliemann, that was what did it when I was 7 years old. I have undergraduate students all the time. I'm actually the advisor for the archaeology majors at George Washington University. We have actually graduated, I've been doing it for 20 years at GW, and we have graduated almost 200 archaeology majors that are now out in the field doing various things. You don't have to become an archaeologist. We have undergraduate majors that are now doctors and lawyers and business people working in NGOs and the government and all that. So I have students every year, but not graduate students. I have undergraduates for college, and we take them digging with us every summer. Whenever we go on a project, that's our labor, because they can do it for university credit. We run a field school. We teach them how to dig all day, and then at night we lecture at them, and they have an exam at the end, and they get 3 credits for that course. So you actually have to go digging if you're an archaeology major. That's part of the requirements.
That sounds super fun. All right, so those are our questions that we always wrap up with, the same 2 questions that we ask everyone. The first question is, if you had everyone's attention in the entire world and you could tell them one thing about archaeology, what would it be?
It's cool.
Great.
And it's harder than you think.
It's more physical. All right. And then the second question is, you still have everybody's attention in the whole world. You can tell them one thing about literally anything. It can be as serious and big picture or insignificant and silly as you'd like.
I would say the answer is 42, and always have your towel with you.
Very good advice. Always have your towel with you, and the answer is 42. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us tonight. This was super, super cool. And Erin, thank you for signing for us. I learned a new word in sign language today that I didn't expect to learn, shotgun. So I don't think I'll need that, but you never know. So thanks so much, everybody, for being with us today. I hope you continue to come to Skype a Scientist Live sessions. If you'd like to join our newsletter, you can by going to bit.ly/SAS, which is Skype a Scientist News. I put that in the Q&A, so you can click that link if you'd like. We only send you 1 email a week. So it gives you a sense of what we're up to this week. Thanks again, everybody, for coming. Thank you, Eric and Erin. We'll see you tomorrow at 1 p.m. to talk about the millennium on the meridian, all about the American Southwest. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.